Welcome to the Digital Leaders Podcast. My guest today is Debbie Forster, MBE. Debbie is a recognized figure in the areas of diversity, tech, innovation, and education. She is co-founder and CEO for the Tech Talent Charter, an industry collective which aims to deliver greater diversity in the UK tech workforce. Welcome to the Digital Leaders Podcast.
Thanks, Robin. Really great to be here.
So let's start with the obvious opening question. Debbie, what is it you do?
So I do what is now grandly called a portfolio career, which means I have several different projects that I'm doing. The biggest part of my portfolio is I'm the CEO of the Tech Talent Charter, but I also do a lot of coaching and mentoring and working with social entrepreneurs as the other part of my portfolio.
Great. So tell us about Tech Talent Charter. It sort of, does it do what it says on the tin?
So the Tech Talent Charter is working to bring together all the vested stakeholders to move the dial on diversity in tech. We mean diversity in its fullest sense. When we really started get going in 2015 into 2017, we needed to start with a focus. So we began with gender. But by the end of last year, it was really exciting to see that a lot of our members were ready to start thinking more broadly about inclusion first and diversity in a more expanded way. So since Christmas, we've also been starting to look at what we can do in relation to things like ethnicity, social inclusion, looking at LGBTQ, the diversity in its widest sense. And I mean tech in its widest sense. So yes, when I think about it, we have employers like our Microsoft and our Cisco and our Salesforce, but we also have Lloyds Bank and Nationwide. We work with Sky TV, Cancer Research UK, and even Domino's Pizza. What we do, though, is not just employers. We wanted to look at the whole of the pipeline and everyone who had a vested interest. So we also have members who are working in the space to help. That can be consultants, that can be recruiters, because they can be part of the problem or the solution. And we look at organizations that are doing something in the space, whether that's Code First Girls, STEMATS, Tech UK. We bring them together to connect, to convene and to amplify what's happening. We focus on what is practical, what works. What I love about our community is our members are willing to share what works and doesn't work, not to treat it like a trade secret. This is so broken. No organization can fix this by themselves. And so we're now up to just about to break 500 signatories who've joined us over the last 3 years and really starting to make some inroads in thinking about making the tech sector more inclusive and more diverse.
So it's a charter, which, and you know, you've talked about 500 signatories. Is the charter sort of like a road map to diversity? If people are finding out about this for the first time on today's podcast, what are the key behaviors or actions that you're encouraging?
We build in first what we think are the four key building blocks if you're going to be on this journey. And the first one is that you've got a senior signatory. For any organization to really move forward in this way, they have to have buy-in at that top table. Now, that can be a CEO, a CTO, a CIO. You have to have that buy-in. We also insist that they have a plan. I worry when people think, and I get this, well, in Q1, we're going to focus on diversity and inclusion. This is not a vaccination. You don't do it once and it's done. For the companies on the journey with us, they know that this is something that needs to be built in, day out, core to their strategic planning. And the great thing about the charter is nobody is saying they have it fixed. Everyone's on the journey. So we do have some members who have been doing this 5, 6, 7 years and making real progress. Others who just woke up and want to do something. Where we start adding value are the next two pillars, and that's practice and data. Our companies are committed to sharing what works and to collaborate. So they do that at our events, which used to be face-to-face and now are online. They do that by sharing things with us on social. And what this means from those activities is we're able to create two parts of our toolkit. The first part of the toolkit is the open playbook of best practice. What we have there are hundreds of examples that companies can look at to understand what they might do to improve their culture, to look at recruitment, retention, how to be more disability friendly, how to be anti-racist. One of our mantras is we need to connect the dots, not reinvent the wheel. Any company who wants to be on this journey doesn't have to start from scratch, doesn't have to invent things themselves. They can look at what's out there and build from there. And our open playbook helps them do that. And it's free. Everything that we do is free. The other piece that we found is that no one, including the government, was really clear who was doing what in the space in relation to diversity and inclusion. So we began mapping that. And so what our members can draw on is our diversity directory. Now, this is again, over 500 initiatives up and down the country that a company can look at to do anything from volunteering in schools to help on tech, up to building a culture, how to work on their recruitment, they're in there. The last part we do, and it is the really hardest part, we believe at the Tech Talent Charter that what's measured gets done. So data is important. The one thing we do make our companies commit to is that every year in September, they submit data to us. And that's mandatory. There's a short part that is mandatory. There's a larger optional piece. And we take that data, we anonymize it, we aggregate it, and then we use that to create the rest of our toolkit. We have an annual report that gives us insights into what's really making a difference with our employers. But we also create a tool where companies can sit down internally to benchmark their progress. This isn't a league table. We don't name and shame. But this allows companies to really sit down and look at not just how they're doing year on year, but to actually look at how they compare with companies in their sector, companies of their size, to understand what's there to celebrate and what they really need to focus on. So that's the charter. It's free to join. And what we have is companies really genuinely collaborate, whether that's building a returners and retraining ecosystem in Leeds, to companies coming together for hack days to really share what's happening to become things like how to become a more inclusive anti-racist employer.
So that sounds great and really impactful. And I really like your what's measured gets done mantra. I think that's something that people can take away from this and think about. And I think it's entirely right. So now what about you, the person, Debbie? So how have you ended up where you are now? And what were your early inspirations? You sound like a campaigner, an entrepreneur, someone who motivates and activates people around ideas. Where did this all start and how has this happened?
A lot of times when people have listened to me this long, the question comes amongst the British audience of who, what is that accent? So, you know, the first thing to say is I didn't start here. I usually describe it as my family think I sound faintly British. The British think I sound faintly Canadian and the Canadians just shake their heads and walk away. I'm originally from the US and from a really tiny town in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico, spent a lot of time growing up in the Southwest, but really wanted to come across. And you talk about early inspirations. When I was in school, tech wasn't a thing. I remember when I was in high school, there was a class called Intro to Computers. As you'd expect, I was one of the few girls in that class, but it was just 1 year. And when it came time to start thinking about careers, I was doing very well in school. And I was told, did I want to be a doctor or did I want to be a lawyer? I wanted neither. And I think like a lot of women who are not natural techies, I knew what I wanted to do. I knew what I wanted, which was to travel, to meet people, to have those sorts of opportunities. So sort of wandered my way into university and became a teacher. I mean, the funny thing is, I was an English teacher and came to this country as an English teacher with a funny accent. But that was in the 90s. And in the 90s, if you used a computer, which I did, you rapidly became in education, the expert. And I found myself suddenly teaching IT. I then found myself around the late 90s being in charge of technology, including running the network. I was one of those people that had to scramble in education to try and think about the millennium bug. That feels like a million years ago, doesn't it? I think for me, what drew me into tech was as an educator in the first instance, because it fired up the young people's learning, and particularly for the young people that I worked with who were, you know, often from more challenging backgrounds, I could see very quickly technology opened doors for my young people into jobs that they might not think about. And that was my first motivation. Since then, I've had what's called, I've read an article recently, is a squiggly career. So I've jumped across sectors a number of times. After 20 years in education, including being a head teacher, during that time, I found myself more and more involved in tech. And in particular, very quickly, if you do much in tech and education, you see that there are no girls. So I was one of the first schools to adopt a program called Computer Club for Girls that was run by an organization at the time, eSkills UK, the Sector Skills Council for Tech, and found myself being pulled more and more into those discussions with government, with industry, with education. What could we do? Around 2010, I was given an offer I couldn't refuse. I'd been a head teacher for 6 years and eSkills UK said, come work with us. So I had my first taste of working with policymakers, working with industry companies like IBM, BT, Microsoft, to see what we could do in the space of trying to equip and attract more young people into tech. 2.5 years of that showed me I'm not a policymaker by instinct. I like getting my hands dirty. There was a startup at the time called Apps for Good. And as soon as I heard it, I loved it. This was getting out and working with young people, helping them choose something they care about, and then showing them the design and tech process and entrepreneurial skills to take it to market. So we helped young people choose a problem space, design an app, and take it to market. It was called Apps for Good, and I loved it. Everything about it seemed to tick the boxes of what industry needed, what I knew schools wanted, and what young people would enjoy doing. So I, after meeting the founder, talking for a while, got excited, said, I speak educationese. If you're interested, call me. She did. I quit my job, sat down with her, and then said, oh, good Lord, you've only done this in one place, one school and one community center. But that was my first part of the entrepreneurial journey. I joined, I became co-CEO, and we grew Apps for Good from those 70 kids, one school and one community center. And over 5 years while I was there, we reached 75,000 young people. And a half of those young people aged 10 to 18 were girls. You know as well as I do, that's not a stat. 50% girls in tech is not a sentence you hear. So then I found myself pulled into discussions about tech and women. And that's where I started becoming part of the Tech Talent Charter. My co-founder, Sinead Bunting, working with people like Amali De Alwis, pulled a group of us together to say, let's do something in this space. I was at a point where I knew if I had to go, I think the way I described it, Sinead, was if I had to go to one more roundtable event, why there's no women in tech, my head will explode. If I have to focus on and hear talking about the problem one more time, my head will explode. Let's do something different. And so back in 2016, on top of our day job, it started. Then when I took the decision to leave Apps for Good, I offered to sort of give a push to the Tech Talent Charter. That was 2017. And here I am today.
Wow. Great journey. Gosh, New Mexico to...
Yeah, New Mexico by way of Texas. So when I first came here, I had the accent and had to learn how to speak British very quickly. Because if you'd work at a boys' school, you don't get away with that American accent or the vocabulary for very long.
So just whereabouts in the UK have you been?
My interesting journey was to go, first of all, I had been at university and taught for a year in Texas. And then I had a scholarship to work on my master's through Rotary Clubs, of all things, and found myself in Leeds, in Yorkshire. And this was Yorkshire, Leeds, 1989. So that was pre-posh. This was pre-Harvey Nicks. When I go back to Leeds, I can barely recognize it. But the journey from Texas to Leeds was not as much a shock as you think. That's a whole other story, but Texans and Yorkshiremen and women have a lot more in common than you think. Came down south, and I've been sent down south ever since.
So I'm very glad you landed in Leeds, because God's own country.
Let me tell you, and that's where, and I left God's own country. And I say Texans would say that's the same. So I clearly had a calling to be in God's own country, wherever it was.
So yeah, no, Leeds was, I grew up near Leeds, and it was, those were the glittering lights was Leeds. Yeah. So, but like yourself, I came south, and I've been London based for a long time now.
Tectonic Charter, we're doing a project up in Leeds. And so it was amazing for me. It was almost 30 years to the month that I found myself back up at Leeds with this project. So again, you may leave Yorkshire, but you never fully lose it. You always find yourself going back. So pre-lockdown, I was going up to Yorkshire a lot, and it still remains a really exciting place to be with a lot going on.
I have to agree with you on that. So here we are in lockdown, but I'm sure that hasn't held you back. And have you got a particular program or activity that you're focused on right now?
By Christmas, we knew from our signatories that it was time to start broadening, that we were ready not to abandon gender. Gender is far from done, but to focus only on gender is to miss the point, and to not really think more widely about intersectionality, about fuller inclusion, was important. So interestingly, as I said to you, back in January, we announced at our national event that in broadening and seeking partnerships, we were going to look at social inclusion and we're going to look at ethnicity. Now you look now at COVID and who has been hardest hit, it's been women, it's been those who are socially excluded to start with. And then if you think we're looking at ethnicity and Black Lives Matter, comes into play, and we're at the heart of things. And back in 2017, when we really started the charter, that was the year of gender pay reporting, Weinstein, Me Too. In this country, there was that President's Club debacle. And back in 2017, we said, you know, I love Churchill's never waste a good crisis. And while everyone was woke and realizing that this was a real problem in gender that had to be fixed and had a benefit if you fixed it and a risk if you didn't, I look at 2020 and what we said in January places us again at the heart of there is a crisis and we're not going to waste it. And while people are awake and looking around, we push forward. And so in thinking about how we get the sector to think about how to be anti-racist, to get the sector to really try and bottom out, how are we reaching in to those people who are normally socially included? I think that social inclusion piece is valuable, is important. And we had a campaign that we had announced some time ago. One of the things we realized through our research and talking to companies, let me start as a premise. We know what's happening in schools is not helping us for tech. And it's important, and we focus on that. And we work with another charter called Tech She Can, who's addressing that, what happens in schools. But even if we fix that by this Thursday, which we won't, it's going to take 10 years before the sector can address that. And where we're seeing companies wake up and start doing something about it is not just schools, but to think about alternate routes into tech. Retraining programs, returner programs, career conversion programs, apprenticeships and alternatives. So we wanted to look at, and we saw from a lot of research that there is a huge number of women who are interested in a career in tech, but don't know how to do it. And there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of misconceptions about how to get into tech. So we're in the process of, we began putting together a campaign that now is going to be launched in the autumn and could never feel more relevant. So this is looking at women, finding the stories of real women. We know to help people to get into a sector in which they're not represented, we need to see role models. We need to see people like us. So we reached out before Christmas to our members and said, we want examples of women in your companies. And we're looking really at as diverse as possible. We want the women who got into tech by a side door, by an alternative route. And Robin, it was amazing. We thought we had a campaign. We had the offer of some Rankin photography, and we needed 6 women. So we gave a shout out to our members with a really quick turnaround. Sinead and I thought we'd probably need to shortlist for maybe, I don't know, 60, 70, 80 women. Robin, we got over 300 women who came back to us. And these were stories of women from every walk of life, up and down the country, every age, ethnicity, background, you name it. And from those, toughest part of the job was to find, we actually went up to 8 women. And in the autumn, we're going to be launching a campaign across the country that shows women that they can get into tech and how to get into tech. If you think of the disruption that has happened through COVID, we've got a lot of people, starting with women, who are being displaced from their jobs. We have a lot of sectors who are now in risk. And the one thing we learned during COVID is everybody needs to be a digital company. Everybody has to understand that. So that need for talent is going to grow. And what we'll do is to work with our signatories to help women and other underrepresented groups see that there is a way into tech. And we can bring together what's always been a talent gap for the sector and a lot of people who are going to need to be in a more stable, growing, thriving sector. And that is tech, that is digital. And we'll begin bringing them together in the autumn.
That sounds like a great campaign. So has Rankin photographed these eight women?
It was a Rankin photography studio. So we have the pictures of the women. But what we'll do building from that is to look also at the stories of those other 300 women and the other women up and down the country who have got into tech and telling their stories of how they got in. Amongst our members, there are some great programs that companies run internally. We have members that run great programs of helping people think about how they might get into tech, how they might convert from one career to another, how to do retraining, rethinking, reinventing apprenticeships. It's a chance to really raise that awareness, pull the curtain back, help people realize, women in particular, the sheer range of jobs that are out there in relation to tech and the many ways in which they can find in. We're not going to pretend it's easy. Changing your career, learning something new is not an easy thing, but it's an important thing. And everything we know from the research says everyone, we're all going to have to be on the journey that we're always ready to and on the path of retraining, rethinking. And tech is a great way to start learning how to do that.
Obviously, this is the Digital Leaders podcast, so we need to talk about digital leadership. Maybe just share with me some thoughts around the importance of a digital leader's understanding of the power of diversity of thought and building a team that thinks in a diverse way. What is the value of if you're running a team in a digital space at the moment and they all look a bit like you? You know, that's comfortable, probably makes for sort of easy conversations, but why is that not a good thing, and why should they change the way they think about that?
And I think when we're talking about this, the first thing to say that I always want to say is when we say digital leaders, we therefore mean everyone. You know, every leader since COVID shutdown has realized they have to have digital leadership. They have to understand that dimension. But if I'm looking at people who already know and have grasped that I am a digital leader, inclusion and diversity, we now have the business case and the statistics to show it's not just a good thing to do, it's a really smart business thing to do. You know, we've got all the McKinsey stats that are coming through that shows having a diverse team positively impacts the bottom line, your ability to move into new markets, to survive disruption. But I'd go even deeper. What was interesting is recently Accenture did a study, and what they showed that with all of those things that we say diversity does, inclusion and having an inclusive culture is a multiplier effect there. And I think it's really important, because what I get worried, and I saw some of this starting to crop up last year, is what I refer to as the takeaway window approach to diversity. You get these panicked digital leaders who have heard something about diversity and then run to their recruiters or run to their HR departments. And it's like a takeaway window. I would like 3 women, 2 BAME, and if you can get me a neurodiverse and an order of chips to go. That never works. That's never lasting. They rarely are able to attract the right people, and they certainly can't keep them. If I'm talking to a leader and trying to understand why do you want diversity? Why does it matter? And I'd go further and say, why does an inclusive culture matter? Number one, to the people who don't see themselves as diverse and therefore may not need inclusion, I would say this. I last year had a serious injury. I had to have surgery, which meant I spent the better part of a year on crutches, in a wheelchair, in a brace, everything else. And I suddenly had a sense of every meeting I went to, every event I was at, 20% of my brain was always trying to think, how do I get out of the room? Do I need to leave early? Where's the loo? Because of that glimpse I had at disability. So what I now say to people is, if you are never going to get older, if you are never going to have a serious illness or be injured or have surgery, if you're never going to have children or have to care for them, if your parents or family are never going to be ill or need caring, if you are never going to have mental health challenges or someone that you love, then probably you don't need inclusion. If that's a chance for any of you, then you need this. For managers, if you don't have an inclusive culture, that 20% of the brain, everyone who's not a parent in a non-family friendly environment, 20% of my brain is always trying to figure out, how do I arrange the time so I can pick up the kids? Who's going to take this? Who's going to do that? If I am LGBTQ in a homophobic office, I'm checking my pronouns. My part of my brain is always trying to think, am I presenting straight enough? What do I say that doesn't give something away? As a manager, if I want 100% of my team's thoughts, focus, energy, then I want to be as inclusive as possible. And then if we're thinking in tech, you want a team that doesn't just almost understand what it's like to be other people. You need a team that is designing, that is building, who thinks and represents your customer, your client, your user. We know the bottom line is that's where you get the best products, the most user-friendly outputs, the best services. And finally, I'm always hearing, and there's always the stats on one of the biggest risks for any tech team is they can't get enough good people. And I would say to them, because you're only fishing in part of the pond. So it really becomes, the more time goes on, this no-brainer. And it is why we've grown so quickly at the Charter. You know, when we started back in 2017, in March of 2017, we had 17 companies. We're now 500. We're having employers like Microsoft who are holding out their partners pledge, insisting that if you're a Microsoft partner, that you begin making commitments on a number of issues, including inclusion and diversity. It is something that's here. It's not going to go away. It's not something that can be solved, as I said, in one quarter, two events, and something on, you know, Pride and International Women's Day. But for those companies that are on the journey to become more inclusive, to really seek out to get that more diverse talent, they're making gains. They're getting more talent. They're keeping better talent. We know the millennials and Gen Z are looking for those companies, even if they're not an underrepresented group. They're starting to ask really hard questions of employers because they want to know they're working for companies that get it and are on the journey.
Powerful stuff. I really like the 20%.
It was having to live it that really made me see what happens because, you know, as a woman, I was already accommodating it, but it was suddenly really finding myself in unfamiliar territory, going into buildings where you think and they say it's disability friendly and it's clearly not. And that's really what started my brain thinking how much when we have underrepresented groups, how much of their brains we're losing, how much of their energy we're losing while they're solving problems they shouldn't have to solve.
Yeah, I mean, in old language, it was kind of walking a mile in someone else's shoes. And
I rolled and limped and went on the crutches. Yeah. To really make sure it was funny because we had at the start of that year when we'd said things, we needed to look. And I said, yes. And I remember actually saying in a meeting, we really need to think about disability and how are we as tech employers doing that? And clearly the gods looked across that and thought, Debbie learns by doing. So let's give her a little taste of that to see what happens.
Brilliant. It's been great talking to you. We need to do our quickfire round where Absolutely. Hopefully we find out a few more things about you. So the first one is you get to choose a book. Tell us who it's by and why you've chosen it.
I think the one I have to say, because it just keeps knocking the socks off me and I keep returning to it again and again, and that's Invisible Women, Caroline Criado Perez. She really unpacks the gap on data that we have in relation to gender for the women and the impact this has across the piece. It's a book that I loved, devoured, I quote, I return to it again and again, but one I could only read a chapter and then I'd have to stop for a while and stomp around the room because I was so cross. But it definitely a must read.
Brilliant. And that a nice segue for me because Caroline keynoted at our Power and
Responsibility Conference. Yes, I was very jealous. I was out of the country for that event and kicked myself the whole time.
Yeah. So we return for another Power and Responsibility Conference on the 26th of November. We will be sending out more details of that. So you're also going to have lunch with one guest, living or dead. So who are you going to choose?
Oh, and I thought about it. And I don't know if it's just because I recently saw her on the Netflix piece. I want to have lunch with Michelle Obama. I was fortunate enough to get to hear her speak about 2 years ago in Scotland and went to this event with this massive girl crush, hoping against that she wouldn't disappoint. And she was amazing. So yes, I would love to sit down opposite that woman to talk because of what she does, but just also because of how just completely down to earth and authentic she is. I find me a way, Robin, get me lunch with Michelle and I'm yours for life.
We'll do our best. That would be a cracking, that would be a cracking lunch. I have to agree. And last but not least, our listener always likes to know one thing about you that may surprise them.
I'm always trying to learn something new. And so one thing I did about 2 years ago that surprised people is I love to have a glass of wine, you know, like most of us. But I suddenly decided I want to learn about it. So I am a level 2 sommelier. I did the course. I took the test. I've got my little certificate and pen. And it was the best homework and revision I've ever done, Robin. And I've tried to carry it on. So while we've been on lockdown, I've been trying to learn Spanish. Now, I am not a linguist by heart. My partner and I have been having a weekly online session with a teacher. Now, I've been doing that now for 3 months. I am more confident. The only way that you can see that is I now occasionally inadvertently answer a call, open a call with hola chicas or chicos. But I'm working on that. Once COVID opens locks, I want to go back to Spain and try it out. But you know, if I've got my qualification in wine and I can speak my Spanish a little bit, I can't wait to get back abroad.
That sounds great. So can you sip a glass of wine and tell us which valley or which sort of soil it grew on?
No, do you know, I can do. What was interesting, what I really loved about the course was it demystified it. And it did. So I can talk to you about grapes I love and regions I love. And it also really unlocked. So there's no mystery now when I read the wine list and the descriptors. It really removed the pretension. One of my great takeaways I love, because it was a great course, the two bits. Would you know what is a great pairing for fish and chips?
Not a clue. I mean, I'd obviously have a salmon.
Champagne. I'd go to a salmon. Now, champagne is a great pairing for fish and chips because the dryness of that cuts through the oiliness of the fish and chips. So next time you go for your fish and chips, grab yourself a bottle of champagne, try it, and you'll never look back.
I've been doing that for years, Debbie. So I just didn't know why it tasted so good. So I needed you to explain that process. Well, that is great. And you're putting us all, there'll be lots of people listening thinking, I really should have used my lockdown more. I mean, I think I'm three quarters of the way through Spooks on iPlayer. I'm afraid I didn't learn a language. So well done for that. So look, Debbie, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the Digital Leaders Podcast.
Thank you so much, Robin. It's been a real pleasure.
That is it for this episode of the Digital Leaders Podcast. Now, of course, we would love to know your thoughts. Tag us at DigiLeaders and let us know. And if you want to find out more about today's guest, head on over to our website, digileaders.com/podcast, and we have all that information there. That is it for this week. I'm your host, Robin Knowles. Thank you so much for listening. And we'll be back soon with another episode of the Digital Leaders Podcast.